Our moderator today is Cook County Board President. Few quick things about her. She's a frequent attendee at City Club of Chicago events, for which we are enormously grateful. And she also encourages her leadership team to speak at the City Club of Chicago. She earned her bachelor's degree and master's degree at University of Chicago. She is the mother of two beautiful children and grandmother of three beautiful geniuses. Our moderator today, Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. Madam President.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm very grateful to be here and be part of this panel. I want to thank you for joining us. I think it's important to note that we have people from the corporate community, not-for-profits, healthcare professionals, criminal justice professionals here with us today, because this is an issue that crosses all those boundaries, and all of us have an interest in addressing it. So I'm old and the light's not so good here, so you have to bear with me a little bit. I want to thank the club for bringing everybody together around this issue. And as with many national health crises, it's easy to think that the people who are hurt are a long way away, in far-off places. We've all seen the media coverage of the impacts of the opioid epidemic in West Virginia, in Ohio, in New Hampshire. And if you only watch TV, you'd think that opioid deaths only occur in rural areas and gun deaths only happen in Chicago. But believe me when I tell you that the opioid epidemic is silently ravaging Cook County. Let me share with you some shocking statistics from our medical examiner's office. Opioid-related overdoses increased 70% between 2015 and 2016, from 647 deaths to 1,091. That's more than the number of people who died from gun violence, 805, and more than deaths due to motor vehicle accidents, 278. Actually, the gun deaths and the accident deaths don't add up to the opioid deaths. Their opioid deaths are more. We've already had 847 opioid-related deaths in 2017. That's not a real-time figure because sometimes it takes weeks or months to get the toxicology reports back to determine the exact cause of death. And there's also been a dramatic increase in fentanyl and fentanyl-related deaths. In 2016, there were 562 deaths contributed to fentanyl and fentanyl analogs, and as of last week, there were 485 deaths for 2017 alone. This is a crisis that crosses all socioeconomic, racial, gender boundaries, and it takes many forms, from prescription pain pill abuse to the use of illicit street drugs like heroin. Reports indicate that if opioid deaths continue to increase at their current rate, within the next decade, the annual death toll in the United States could surpass the deadliest year of gun violence or the worst year of the AIDS epidemic, when 50,000 Americans were dying annually. 50,000. The fight against this public health crisis must be comprehensive and aggressive. As Cook County Board President, public health is a significant component of my responsibilities. And our health and hospital system represents, as many of you know, about half of our budget. So public health, whether you use the system or not, impacts everyone. Our Cook County Health System has expanded its role as a healthcare safety net to meet the demand for mental health and substance abuse services. We've responded to the crisis by increasing the availability of addiction treatments, establishing a community triage center in Pullman, and increasing detox and recovery services at the jail, including providing at-risk detainees with naloxone, the opioid antidote. Finally, before we bring our panelists up, I want to make a point about which I feel very strongly. For decades in this country, drug use and abuse was treated as a criminal justice matter, with enforcement of drug laws particularly harsh in black and brown communities. There was a national war on drugs, which amounted, frankly, to a war on black and brown neighborhoods. And substance abusers found themselves in the criminal justice system rather than treating substance abuse and addiction as a public health crisis. But now, of course, the opioid epidemic hits people, as I said, across socioeconomic and racial bounds. It's inner-city residents, white suburban youth, middle-class residents around the country, people in depressed rural communities. And finally, we've come to the point where we've decided that it's appropriate to look at treatment and prevention rather than detention and incarceration. And I can't help but think that's a function of the changing racial patterns of our substance abuse crisis. A bitter note on my part. When black and brown people are the principal focus of substance abuse and addiction, the response is detention and incarceration. And when white people are the victims of substance abuse and addiction, we talk about prevention and treatment. The racism in this country affects us in profound and sometimes unexpected ways. On that note, I want to introduce our panelists for today's discussion. First of all, the Honorable Patrick Kennedy. Thank you very much for joining us, Patrick. Patrick has dedicated his life to raising awareness and establishing resources for individuals suffering from mental illness, addiction, and other brain diseases. He was in the House of Representatives for 16 years and championed important health care legislation, including the Mental Health Parity and Substance Abuse Equity Act of 2008. He's been candid in sharing his own journey with mental illness and addiction and founded the Kennedy Forum, which is focused on transforming the mental health system in the U.S. And I want to thank the O'Briens, who are here today, who've taken a lead role in our own local efforts around the Kennedy Forum. Dr. Steve Axe, a board-certified emergency medicine physician and medical toxicologist. I got that out. Medical toxicologist at Cook County Stroger Hospital. He is a national opioid expert and one of the foremost specialists in the field of medical toxicology, specializing in addiction prevention, street drug trends, and acute toxicology. Dr. Axe received his medical degree from the New York College of Osteopathic Medicine and is board-certified in emergency medicine and medical toxicology. Thank you, Dr. X. And finally, Jay Edelson, the founder and CEO of Edelson PC. He's considered one of the nation's leading class and mass action lawyers, having secured over $1 billion in settlements and verdicts for his clients. Jay and his team represent a wide range of clients in the opioid litigation, including municipalities, counties, states, labor unions, and self-insured corporations. He was most recently selected to represent both the City of Chicago and Cook County in the high-profile litigation involving Uber's data breach. Now, I'll ask each panelist for a few opening comments, and if it goes on before a few, I will come up and tap you on the shoulder, and then we'll engage in conversation. I'm going to begin with our guest from out of town, Patrick, the Honorable Patrick Kennedy.
Thank you. Thank you, President Preckwinkle, and thank you to the club for allowing me to be here. My good old friend, Jay Doherty, was so good to my late father and to the Shrivers, all my family over the years. Thank you, Jay. We have the Kennedy Forum event on January 16th, just to put another plug in. There is no political organization in this space that we need in order to push back. When I was the lead author of the principal mental health bill on the Hill, the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act, I could count on one hand the number of people who would give me money. Now, I'm not just but laying it out there, okay? Up until last year, there was not ever a manual handed to new members of Congress outlining, no matter what committee they were on in Congress, this is what they could do to advance the mental health and well-being of our country. If you're on the housing committee, you can do this. If you're on the education committee, you can do this. Most people thought, well, mental health, it must be on that health subcommittee of energy and commerce. Furthest thing from the truth, as you've spoken about, President Preckwinkle, this crosses every single boundary and jurisdiction. And yet our response as a nation has been narrowly focused. And as you said, President Preckwinkle, the answer to this problem is a comprehensive answer that involves all sectors of society, which is why it's so important that all sectors of society are represented in this room today. So I look forward to a conversation about how to advance this, but I come back to the politics, because if we can't organize Jorge an AFL-CIO of mental health that has one common agenda as opposed to a fractionalized agenda between the addiction folks over here, the schizophrenia advocacy groups over here, the homeless groups over here, the veterans groups over here, the depression bipolar folks, you've got my point. We are suffering when we really could benefit from a common 1-2-3 pull. We're all still pulling, but we're not pulling at the same time, and hence we're stuck in a situation where this is the largest public health crisis of our time, and we're doing nothing about it. $500 million, and I'll conclude with this, $500 million is being spent annually a year by the federal government. In the height of the AIDS crisis, we were spending $23 billion a year. $23,000 per AIDS patient versus $113 per addiction patient. That's what we as a society are doing in response to this crisis.
Thank you. Dr. X.
Okay. Well, it's absolutely a pleasure to be here with this panel. I'm an ER doctor, so my usual business, I'm seeing patients at the bedside, and I've been doing that for about 25 years. I'm also a medical toxicologist, so I've also consult on patients with the suffering from substance use disorders. I've been doing this for my whole career. My group, Toxicon, we're partners with the Illinois Poison Center, so I've had the perspective of seeing at the bedside, countywide, and statewide, what's going on with this epidemic. And really, just watching this grow as a healthcare professional has been absolutely shocking. And I agree, this is the largest public health problem of our age, and it's in my specialty, and that's why I'm here and why I'm involved. You know, early in my career, we watched a street drug problem become a pill problem. But in 2003, that was when things flipped, when basically, pills as a cause of death exceeded street drugs. I mean, I found this shocking, and I'll echo a lot of the president's comments that this is something we just saw the demographic shift. In our health system, we saw ED visits increase from 1,000 in 2006 up to 5,000 visits in 2016. This is crazy. It's unacceptable. It just skyrocketed. We have had this shift in medicine that we can't view this as an episodic thing where someone just gets detoxed, they shake it off, and they're going to be fine. This is a chronic illness that will never leave that individual. And we have to think of substance use disorder as being analogous to diabetes, hypertension, asthma. Patients must have access to a doctor, and that doctor has to be able to access all kinds of services for substance use disorder, as well as all the wraparounds. And again, that's why, as we've just heard, we need to have all the services together to improve the lives of these folks. I just wanted to let you know some of the things we've been doing within the health system, because I think this is the largest problem facing us now. I'm very proud to be part of an organization that is putting this front and center. So we've expanded MAT, medication-assisted treatment. So that's usually in the form of buprenorphine or another drug, naltrexone. Our clinics, we've been bolstering them. And here's what I think the winning strategy is. We are now training our family doctors also to do the same treatment in their clinics. And I think that this is the message that we have to really support. primary care doctors have to be able to give this form of treatment, and we need to put all the resources we can behind it. If somebody has runs into this, they go see their doctor. If their doctor can treat them and do this on a long-term basis, that's a winning strategy. We have to work on these warm handoffs. People should be able to access the system at any point and know that they're going to get connected with someone who will pick up their care and get them to the right place. As a doctor, I think that my community has finally understood the power of the prescription pad. And I think we've actually been doing a lot over the last 4 or 5 years, and I think we're clearly moving in the right direction. Our ER, we have a prescribing guideline. We don't write for more than 3 pills for someone who, or 3 days of an opioid for an acute injury. And I think this is aligned with a lot of efforts going on nationally. We're working on prescribing guidelines throughout our Cook County Health and Hospital system. I think it's really important. Naloxone. Naloxone is a life-saving drug that if someone overdoses on an opioid, you can give them an injection and that'll bring them back to life. Never in my career did I imagine that I would be prescribing this stuff to go on the street, and we've been doing this now. We partnered with Dan Bigg of Chicago Recovery Alliance, and now our program went from this little program in the ER, it is now system-wide, and it's amazing. I see Dr. Manella is here from our jail. I would say now that we're system-wide, even in our jail, under her direction, as well as with the great pharmacy staff, they've been able to train more than 1,000 people already. 2,000. So actually, I think that deserves a round of applause. That's amazing. And it's about a partnership between clinicians, law enforcement, all of us. We have to work together to figure this out. Again, and just to echo a couple more comments about the medical examiner and the work Dr. Arun Kumar is doing. Shocking. 650 people died in 2015. 1,100 in 2016. And what we learned working together is that 80% of these people in Cook County are dying from street drugs. So it's heroin or this fentanyl. So if you go to the hospital and you broke a bone and they want to give you fentanyl, by all means, take it. In the hands of physicians and in a healthcare setting, it's a wonderful drug. The stuff on the street, it's not coming from prescriptions. It's not coming from doctors. It's coming from knockoff labs out of the country, and it's being dumped on our streets, and it's disgraceful. You know, Lauren, we need to get a handle on this. I have no idea how. That's not my area. But people should understand, it's not a prescribing problem. It is a supply problem. And then just to wrap up, I can't emphasize this enough. Substance use disorder is a lifelong illness. We need to make sure these folks have access to primary care, to addiction services, to all the wraparounds, the social services, economic opportunities. It's critical. And everyone in this room has to destigmatize this problem. I mean, this can happen to anyone. I can't imagine there's anyone in this room that doesn't have a personal anecdote of someone that they're attached to who's been affected by this.
Thank you, Jay.
Mind if I borrow this? Well, first I want to thank President Preckwinkle and the City Club. It's definitely an honor to be here with the real leaders of putting this issue in the spotlight. When I hear the term opioid epidemic, I struggle with it. It definitely is an epidemic, but I start thinking of other epidemics, of polio, of AIDS, of malaria, and in all of those, there are losers and there aren't winners. This is a purposeful epidemic. It is very different, and I'm sure we'll have time to get into this. What we believe has happened, and what we're gonna, my background is as a litigator, and you know the old joke: surgeons think every solution can be solved with surgery. Litigators think it all can be solved through the law, and I think that really is going to be the case. Congressman Kennedy talked about we're not going to get support from the federal government here, and cities and states and counties really don't have the resources to fight it. I think we're going to see this happen through litigation, but that's generally the lens I'm going to talk about this. What we think we're going to be able to establish through our court cases is that in the 1990s, the drug manufacturers made a really cynical decision. They had these opioids where there wasn't enough demand. And the reason there wasn't enough demand was because they were being used in only extreme situations and usually for short times, end of life, end-stage cancer, or if there was someone had a serious surgery and you'd be on medication for a short period of time. Because of that, they weren't selling enough pills. So what did they do? Well, what we think we're going to be able to demonstrate is they decided to change the narrative. They set up shell corporations and fake research and started convincing doctors and the public that they had this new pill, OxyContin, which was basically the same thing as what they'd been selling all along. The difference they claimed was it wasn't addictive in the same way. And because of that, it could be used on everything. And that's what happened. We now have, in certain states, there are more prescriptions than per people in a state. I mean, think about that. Doctors were convinced, and my wife's a doctor. I understand the angle you're coming from. They were told over and over again through research, which they thought was legitimate, that this was stuff that you could prescribe on an ordinary basis all of the time. And it's just not true. So this is an epidemic, but it's an epidemic caused by multi-billion-dollar pharmaceutical companies who have made an incredible amount of money off of this. So our estimates are that society alone is paying somewhere between $80 billion and $500 billion a year. The difference is whether you count the cost of lives. If you factor the cost of lives into it, which I think you should, it goes to $500 billion. If you exclude that, it's still $80 billion a year. At the same time, Big Pharma is making hundreds of billions of dollars. What's nice is people have talked about the cross-section of communities who have been rallying around it. That's what we've seen in the litigation as well. In the closest analog is the tobacco suits in the 90s, which ended up being very successful, but those were driven by the states. Here what we're seeing is the litigation is driven by an amazing cross-section of states, cities, counties, labor unions, self-insured businesses, Indian tribes. It is an incredible thing to witness. Everybody is collaborating to come together to try to find a solution because the resources, I think, aren't there otherwise. I can end with that.
All right. Thank you, Jay. Jackie, I think we have teams around the room who are collecting questions, and we'd love to have those questions. In the meantime, I've got an opening one for our panel. I'm going to keep this brief. Without going into a lot of detail, how did we get to this point? Patrick?
So, as Jay illustrated, there's a great book called Dreamland, and it talks about the perfect storm that was created very intentionally, as he said, by that principally focused on Purdue Pharma, kind of co-opting the medical societies, you know, lobbying centers for Medicare and Medicaid that they should rank pain as a vital sign, and then lobbying Congress to make it such that if they didn't treat pain, they'd lose reimbursement from the federal government. So the point here is everybody is culpable here. There are big players who made this all happen, but believe me, to clean it up, you need the medical society. Right now, the medical society is doing what we don't want them to do, and that's running away from this crisis. Why? Because they're so scared, because they were part of getting us in the crisis, because they were told this is what they're supposed to do. Now they don't want to deal with addiction patients. They don't want to get trained up to treat addiction through medication-assisted treatment, because, oh, that opioid, oh, DEA is going to be breathing down my back. Who would want DEA breathing down? There's plenty of work elsewhere in the medical space. Why would anyone want to go out there and start treating people with addiction? And that's what's happening right now. So we have too few doctors helping. And as I said, if we don't have the resources, kind of commitment on the federal government side, we can't take templates like Stevens and take them to scale, because you guys have a template and there are other templates around the country, but what you're lacking is the proper resources to give that recovering person the recovery coaching, the recovery support group, the recovery housing, the support of employment that can get them off and going so that they're not endemically in the system. We know how to do this. President Preckwinkle, you know it. We know how to. What's missing is the political will that would put the gasoline in the, you know, tank so that we can actually move the recovery forward and address this crisis. We dropped the HIV/AIDS, as you point out, 53,000 Americans dying every year. We dropped it to under 10 within a decade. But guess what? We quadrupled the funding for HIV/AIDS, and guess what? That's how we got the better numbers. If you don't have the dollars associated with this, you're never going to get the results. This crisis is going to rage on because these drugs are coming in. China is pumping them out, and we're not doing, frankly, anything about it, in spite of what the president said he told, you know, President Xi. They are pumping out the fentanyl. And you know who the biggest mass distributor of it is? Is U.S. Postal Service. So we've got big problems on our hands because this stuff's being mailed in. An envelope of fentanyl can kill like a million people. That's how powerful this carfentanil that's coming in. And it can be in as small an envelope as your regular first-class mail. So we're not talking about bales of marijuana coming across and having to have these intricate, you know, routes and drug smuggling. This is going to stick with us, because how do you deal with a drug that can come in a first-class pouch and kill so many Americans at the time when it's delivered? So,
just comment.
Dr. X.
just a comment, and I'll echo that book recommendation, Dreamland. It really is a fabulous narrative to help understand how we got to this. The one additional thought I'd like to give everyone is I think we should take some responsibilities being humans, in that we are addictive in our nature, that this is part of who we are. I mean, and it's been written about, you look back to Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, there was a pill called Soma, where people just want to check out and be pain-free. In reality, I think, you know, if we're ever sold something where we think that we're going to get to this place, people buy stuff on, you know, through the internet all the time, they're trying to feel good, feel better, that we are that, we're that type of society. I think we have to understand this about ourselves, and that'll also help drive the conversation forward. But, and I agree, what's coming in from out of the country, and I think this is really important because it'll inform policy that it's not prescribing, but it's we need to stop this fentanyl from pouring in over the borders.
That's right.
I'm going to ask Jay Edelson to respond to this, and also we have a related question from our medical examiner, Dr. Arunkumar. How do we hold liable the international actors who are skirting U.S. law to put synthetic drugs onto our streets and killing our citizens?
I want to push back a little bit on what the doctor said, and I say this with the appropriate humility. My wife's a doctor, and I've never, ever in my life won any argument with a doctor, so I'm sure he's right. So, of course, personal responsibility is very important, and the doctor's correct. But just to give you a little bit of flavor of what the drug companies were doing in the 90s, they would hire key opinion leaders, which were doctors who they paid money to go around and market this stuff. And one of the things, when other doctors who weren't paid were reporting that people were getting hooked, they created studies with a new term called pseudo-addiction. And the theory was the people only thought that they were addicted, and the reason they thought that was because they weren't getting enough opioids. So the cure for that was more opioids. So we have to take personal responsibility, but there were large companies that were pouring an incredible amount of money to lie to people, and they share the responsibility as well. And really more so. In terms of the question is a terrific one. As a congressman said, we've got all of these drugs coming over from China. One of the big issues is that these are drug cartels. These are not these are, and Congressman, you may have better facts than I do on this. I'm sure you
do.
The but no, it's but these are serious drug cartels that are working together to get all of this across the border. It's very hard to stop. In terms of the litigation, which is the only thing I know about, holding them responsible is almost impossible on a civil in a civil way. So what you're seeing is the Department of Justice and their criminal prosecutions, which are going to hopefully do something to stem this. But it's going to take an enormous effort. And what I'd say is this enormous effort is borne by the taxpayers. That is the big problem. All the solutions that Congressman Kennedy is saying, which are 100% right, are paid by us. And the big thing is, if I'm right that this was a massive fraud committed on the public, we should not be the ones who are bearing it. It ought to be Big Pharma, and hopefully through litigation efforts, and I think legislative efforts too, that can happen.
Dr. Axe, you wanted to say something?
No. And actually, I know that the term personal responsibility is very charged, so I hope no one took it the wrong way. But I agree with very much of what you said. I think that the medical community also has to be very introspective about when we believed anyone who's been to medical school understands the addictive potential of opioids. And this is something I lecture about this all the time. We have medical students and residents now about how we should never believe anything related to this class of medicine is non-addictive. So, I think we're all working towards the same goal.
All right, I'm going to come back to you, Dr. Axe. This is a question from Kim Fox, our state's attorney. Realizing the origins of the crisis and the recognition that addiction is a health issue, how do we mobilize our communities to support efforts to steer addicts away from jail and into treatment?
Yeah, so I think that's exactly. I mean, what I'm hoping is we need a new model of access to both care, primary care, addiction care, and what we call these wraparound services. We need to, and again, where the funding is gonna come from, I mean, that's why we need everyone in this room to figure out where to bring these resources in. And the problem is, folks that wind up getting into legal trouble because they're incarcerated over a drug problem, it's gotta be a medicalized model. We have to pull people into care. We need to realize that they're gonna be on medication perhaps the rest of their life, and we're going to need to have support systems around them. That includes housing, jobs, and basically new opportunities so they can rebuild lives. These are big problems to solve, and we need everyone in this room to really figure that out.
Patrick, I think you wanted to say something.
Thank you. So I had the chance to author a law in the Congress when I was there that said that the brain was part of the body. And it took us a long time in Congress to debate that and come to the conclusion. My Republican colleagues finally came around and realized that. It was signed by George W. Bush. It was because of that. It was part of the ACA as an essential health benefit for mental health and addiction. Medicaid today is the largest provider of mental health and addiction services. And yet, under the Republican resolution, it's slated to be cut between $800 and $1 trillion within the next 10 years. And you know that's going to happen because shortly, within the next week, we're going to have $1.5 trillion tax cut, which predominantly goes to transnational corporations, not American citizens, transnational corporations, inevitably because our stock market's not roaring enough. This is going to be the biggest mental health addiction vote, criminal justice vote, education vote, housing vote, you name it. This next week, you will not see an more important vote to the future of our country in our lifetime than the vote in the next week. So, at the end of the day, you can't cut the largest provider of mental health and addiction services in the midst of the biggest public health crisis that where this provides the coverage. So we have huge disconnects, as we're all very well aware of right now. I would say to folks, the big picture is the denial. I go back to my advocacy point of view. We all know, coming from families, and in my family, that our tolerance level for alcoholism was really high. Okay? Like, literally, in the middle of important meetings where national leaders of our nation were in our house, wouldn't look up as my mother shuffled through the house in the middle of the day, and I, my siblings, were hoping beyond hope that she would go back into her room so we could lock the door, so that she wouldn't come out and embarrass us anymore. That's how my family coped with that. And right now, as a nation, that's the way we're coping with this issue, where it's staring us in the face. It's not the military that's going to defeat this great country. It's not the economy of China. We're still going to take them every single time. It's going to be this enemy within, in our country, that is going to take us down as a first world power if we don't get about saving our own Americans, because we cannot in this country be a great country. We've got such awful indicators, like we're seeing in both cities and rural America alike. And yet, we have the president gives a great speech and gives nothing to this crisis. Declaration of health emergency qualifies this crisis for $57,000. A lot of my fellow commission members on the president's commission pushed the administration to do a Stafford Act. If we did a Stafford Act, we're going to spend roughly
$200.
The Stafford Act is this emergency fund. You all know when there's a big fire or Hurricane Irma, Maria, Harvey. We just throw the dollars in there. And the beauty about these dollars is they're not held against our budget. My fellow colleagues in the state legislature know all about budgets and how you cannot appropriate more than what is given to you in your committee. Well, guess what? If you've got emergency dollars, none of those get counted. So if you're a Republican, you get to suit up and say, yes, I'm fiscally responsible. I didn't bust the budget in spite of this public health, because now I'm designating it as emergency. Guess what is the other budget that's always a national emergency? The defense budget. That means we can appropriate every single year, 1,000 times a year, more money for defense, and it will never affect our budget line. That's the kind of thing, authorization we need. And yet, for some reason, the president hasn't yet. Hopefully he still will. Because if he does that, we can get a tranche of money that can begin to help us tackle this by taking what the doctor has described, medication-assisted treatment, supportive recovery, you know, supportive housing. We know the mechanisms to give people the optimal chance at having the best opportunity for recovery, but we're just not funding them.
Thank you. I'm going to start with Dr. Axe on this one. This is from Dr. Renee. Help me out. Mar Warren, did I say that right? Man Warren, thank you, from Lurie Children's Hospital. Each of you spoke about treatment. My goal is preventing our children from becoming addicts. How can we develop a balanced approach to cure this epidemic? We'll start with you, Dr. X.
That is a great question. That's the future. So I think the medical community, we have to reeducate ourselves in terms of responsible opioid prescribing. We have to do a lot of education about drug use in general, and we have to be doing excellent messaging on this. When we do prescribe, again, every physician or prescriber just has to realize how powerful their prescription pad is. And the programs that are so important are take-back programs. People have an orthopedic surgery. They have 60 Norcos in the medicine cabinet. Those have to go away. Perhaps we need to rebuild the model where no one gets that many to start with, but we have to do that. So I think I think a combination of within the medical community, also how we teach health in this country has to change. And again, I'll get back to the point I made earlier. To think that a teenager is not going to experiment and wonder about this stuff is just wrong. I mean, we are, it's part of the nature of who we are, but we have to have supportive families, communities, and systems to help guide them through that. And we have to do it differently in the future.
So I hope that there's a checkup from the neck up in every physician's office in this country, starting at pediatrician's offices, so no one thinks getting your mental health and well-being checked on an ongoing basis is anything but the norm in terms of health. And thankfully, we'll have all kinds of new apps and tools to Fitbits, in fact, that can tell us when you're panic attack. Your phone can tell us when you're on the verge of a, you know, psychotic break. I mean, there's just amazing technology that's coming down the line. Your voice can tell what your mood is throughout the day. There's voice signatures. Incredible stuff. But that's going to be the norm. And we also have to, when the doctor asks you, do you have a family history? We can't say, oh, yes, I have a family history of stroke, and there's cancer all throughout my family, and then mum is the word when it comes to, is your family history of mental illness or addiction? Because that, frankly, is the part of your family history you better tell on yourself. Because that's the part of your family history that's going to get you killed if you don't. And we don't have that even to this day. I am, like, very outspoken about my own recovery. I go to my new doctor when I move to New Jersey. He goes, so tell me about yourself. I'm in recovery, I said, opiate addiction and many other addictions. And I'm in recovery. I have asthma. I take Lipitor. First five questions from the doctor was about my asthma. So tell me, how often you take your short-acting inhale? Oh, you do. Oh, you need your... And by the way, all of it was prompted on the screen through his EMR. So institutionally within our medical system, not only do nobody other than the Cook County medical system, our Lori health system, I'll get in trouble now, but who cares? My cousin Chris is the only one on the ballot in my family coming up. So the bottom line is most people in medicine do not get the training or education and have the cultural disposition to know how to approach mental health and addiction, even though primary care docs write 70% of the antipsychotics, antidepressants out there with zero to no training whatsoever. So we need a major cultural shift. And our EMRs are still all private. If we're suffering from addiction, we have this 42...
EMRs are electronic medical records.
Thank you, Secretary. And it's all private. And, of course, then I go to an anonymous meeting in the morning in a basement in case no one really could find me, you know, because that's how we treat these illnesses. Shh.
Yeah.
Don't tell anybody. That's the big part that has to change in our medical system.
Jay, you get the last word.
Okay. Yeah, it's always fun to follow a Kennedy. but you know, my view is that the reason that, I mean, these are the real leaders in fixing the problem. The reason why it's so hard for them is because we have to understand that we have an increasingly addictive society. So the technology, you know, Silicon Valley has made, anyone whose kids knows this, you know, through something that they call stickiness, has made all these apps and all these websites which are training our kids to be young addicts. And that is as big a problem in terms of combating this. I know, you know, we have a 13-year-old son, and getting him to be off of his... I shouldn't be saying this. This is videotape, but, you know, he's not here and he can't stop me. You know, there are times it looks like he's a drug addict going for those electronics. And, you know, Silicon Valley's not doing this intentionally, but they're priming our kids to engage in more addictive behavior and more serious addictive behavior. And that's something I think that society has to confront as well.
Thank you. I want to thank our panel members, Dr. X,
former Representative Kennedy, and of course Jay Adelson for joining us today, and all of you for being here. This is a real challenge. This is a real challenge, not just to us in the city and the county, but across the country. And I think Patrick Kennedy is right. We've got some real work to do in terms of finding the resources to address it. Thank you so much. Patrick, do you have a suggestion for our last question?
No, but I have a message I want to get out.
Fine. Deliver your message.
So it's called ParityTrack.org. ParityTrack.org. That's our medical civil rights, because it says you cannot treat a mental illness and an addiction any differently by an insurance company than you would treat any other physical illness. This is federal law, but it's never been enforced, Jay. If you want to have a, if there's a conspiracy by the pharma, there's also a conspiracy by insurers and how they have deliberately neglected following this federal law. There was a powerful Milman report that was done last week that said that nowhere in this country do people with mental illness and addiction get the same access to services for mental health. No surprise, of course. But it was pretty scathing in that it was Milman that did the report, which is always hired by these insurance companies, and they're the ones that did the assessment. 43 million records they did over the last couple of years. If you wanted to go to the Kennedy Forum website, you can learn more. But and if you support the Kennedy Forum, our job is to try to get parity enforced here in Illinois, where guess what? It is not enforced. Any surprise? Anybody? Takers? We need to enforce that, because otherwise people get shifted to the public system, right? If the private players don't do their job, people are out the door, and they get sick, they get sicker, and then they end up, and President Preckwinkle's system has to take care of them, and everybody else has to take care of them. So let's do our job in enforcing the law. That's all it is, equally across the board. No one's a bad actor here on the insurer's part, provided they follow the law. That's all we're saying.
All right, I think we're going to end it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.